have vowed. Better is it that thou shouldst not vow than that thou shouldest vow and not pay. Suffer not thy mouth to cause thy flesh to sin, neither say thou before the angel that it was an error. Why shouldest God be angry at thy voice and destroy the work of thy hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words there are also many vanities, but fear thou God. If thou seest the oppression of the poor, and violent perverting of justice and righteousness in a province, marvel not at the matter. For he that is higher than the highest regardeth, and there are higher than they. Now just three more verses at the end of the chapter. Go down with me to verse 18. Behold that which I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and to drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life, which God giveth him. For it is his portion, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion, and to rejoice in his labor. This is the gift of God, for he shall not much remember the days of his life, because God answereth him in the joy of his heart. Our brother Bob Harper now will open up the portion to us and possibly maybe enter somewhat into the sixth chapter too in his intimations. Brother Bob.
Something that just sort of left over from last time that I'd like to share with you concerning chapter 4, which we didn't get into too much yesterday, which has to do with the fact that there's an awful lot in that fourth chapter about work and money. And three of the things that I note as I was studying that chapter was that there are at least three of the basic motivations for life, for working, for earning money, for so forth and so on. And in each case, he shows what these are, and then he gives the basic moral connected with it. I'm just going to mention these, and then you can look them out for yourself. One of the big aspects of work, like found in chapter 4 and verse 4, is that of competition and rivalry. I have been a salesman for some time, part of my life at least, and I guess Carol's been a salesman most of his life, from what he tells us. And one of the things that is so important in sales is competition and rivalry. And each man doing the very best that he possibly can. Now, Solomon says, this kind of competition leads to nothing more than rivalry and envy. It doesn't really put the person on the pedestal as a result of being the winner in competition, but it leaves his brother envious of him between these people who are competitors. And in talking about this, he says in verse 6 of the moral is, it's better to be content with a little than to have much connected with toil and strife. In other words, if I'm going to spend all my days, it's going to be vanity. It's going to be toil and strife if I'm trying to win and win and win and win and be successful in everything. He's not suggesting laziness, but he's suggesting that tremendously difficult situation that you find in the business of the world today. Then in verse 8, he shows a second basic motivation for life, and that's greed and avarice. And even though man gains much from his toil and trouble, even though he does amass a fortune, he tells us there in verse 8 that he's never really satisfied with what he gets. Like Carol said yesterday, better that a man have 12 children rather than $12 million, because he doesn't want the 13th, but he does want the 13th million, and I agree with that. That's exactly what he's saying here. He's never satisfied. And if he's honest with himself, he's going to say, I'm constantly depriving myself just in order to end up with a lot of money. And the moral to it, he gives in verses 9 to 12, that friendships are much more valuable than money, that it's cold and lifeless and can offer no companionship. Actually, it tends to separate believers rather than unite them. You recall that Abraham and Lot were doing well until they got a lot of money. And then the herdsmen of Lot and all of his people and all of his herds had to be separated from the herdsmen of Abraham. And even in our assemblies, I find that there is quite a difference in social strata, that money seems to be the basic separation in our assemblies. I don't know why that is, but it turns out to be that way. And so he says, better to have a little and share it with friends than to have a lot and be left alone. And then the last one is the idea of advancement and prestige and moving up into the company, being kicked upstairs and becoming the president and so forth. And many aspire to this advancement and prestige, especially the kind that political leadership can seem to bring. But he says this fame is very fleeting. Fame is nothing but vanity and striving after wind. You have this aspect of striving, of vanity, of something that is like the breath of your mouth on a cold day. You breathe it out, you see it, you reach for it, and it's gone. He says that's exactly the way these things are. After a man is gone, he is soon forgotten and fame vanishes. I'll never forget, years ago, I was listening to the 500, the Indianapolis 500, when they have it on radio. I'm sure you've heard it on radio. On, is it the 4th of July when they do this? I forget.
Memorial Day.
Thank you. Memorial Day. And I was listening to the race, and Bill Bukovich was really tearing up the track. His car was beating everybody else. But do you know that Bill Bukovich had a crash, and Bill died in the crash? Before the end of the race, there was no more being said about Bill Bukovich. It was all the fella who was leading the race after that. Fame is very, very fleeting. Now, let's get to chapter 5 and chapter 6. The Lord willing, we'll try to get into this now. Now, he says, looking at all these various anomalies, he's mentioned 6 different enigmas, and somebody said, please tell us what that word enigma means. An enigma is a puzzle that's seemingly impossible for one to figure out. Often it's a paradox, 2 things that seem to both be true, and yet one cannot figure the answer to it. And this is what an anomaly or an enigma is. And he's given us in this previous chapter 6 different enigmas, which we looked at yesterday. But then Koheleth says in verse 1 of chapter 5, don't be so discouraged by the facts of these 6 enigmas that you decide to do away with the things of religion. He's saying the thing to do above all else is go to the house of God and go there with the proper kind of attitude. Go with an expectant attitude. Go with the concept that you're going to hear what God is saying to you, rather than telling him what you think he should do. Then he talks about the idea of vows here. He says we need to be careful what we say to God. He said these kind of people usually are very talkative. They're always saying about things that they're going to do this and they're going to do that and how good they are and what they've accomplished for God. And he said it's just a bunch of words. It's a bunch of wind. It's a striving after nothing. He said if you're going to make vows, you better keep them. But it's better that you don't make foolish vows like Jephthah did and then not to keep them. Actually, Jephthah kept his vow, but I believe that, this is an aside, I believe that Jephthah would not have had to have kept that vow. There was a place in the law for a man who made a foolish vow to have it taken care of, but he did not do that. Now, as we read this chapter here, he begins talking about the fact of what happens to men who get so wrapped up in words and then in the things of money. For instance, he says that, I can put my finger on the verse here and hold it up so I can see it. Verse 7, for in the multitude of dreams and many words, there are also diverse vanities. Here's a person that's so wrapped up in his wealth that he's dreaming about. He's having dreams about the problems. He's having dreams about what he's going to do with it. And he says it doesn't do any more than bring vanity or chasing after wind. He said, really the answer is, but fear thou God. And there's another repetition of that, or should I say a repetition of what he started out with respect to indeed fearing God as he should. The preacher ponders these things, and in verses 10 to 12, he tells us not to set our hearts on human possessions and position, the fact that riches cannot provide the satisfaction that the human heart is seeking. Then as you go down through verses 16 and 17, he suggests that the emptiness of these will have given themselves to this at the expense of the chief good, which is enjoyment. He says you can't have riches and enjoy it unless God gives you the privilege of enjoying it. And that's what he comes up with for really the portion or the strophe that we've had starting with chapter 3, runs through chapter 5, and the conclusion comes down in verse 18 through 20. This is the conclusion of the whole matter. Behold, that which I have seen, it is good and comely or fitting, as it says in the,
this is new.
The new Schofield.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it has comely and...
It's good and fitting.
Good and fitting, very good. It's good and fitting for one to eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor that he taketh under the sun all the days of his life which God giveth him. In other words, again, he's repeating the same conclusion that he came to in chapter 2, 24 through 26. He doesn't state it as fully as he did because he stated it once. He figured if you hear it once, you don't have to hear it again. That God is the one who gives the ability to enjoy. And even if you can acquire all that you possibly have or need, he said God has to give you the ability to have the wealth and then to enjoy the wealth, or it's meaningless, it's empty, it's not worth all the trouble that you're going to go to. He says, every man also to whom God hath given riches and wealth, and hath given him power to eat thereof and to take his portion, this is a gift from God. And if you do not fear God and trust him, God will not let you have this gift. Otherwise, he'll actually allow these riches to become an enigma to you, a puzzle. How comes I have all of these things, and yet I have an emptiness inside? Marilyn Monroe had all the fame and money and men and everything that the world considers important, and all she ended up doing was committing suicide herself. And this is, of course, repeated many, many times. Freddie Prinze, as was mentioned earlier, another fellow who had everything going for him, and age and the acclaim of people and money, anything that he could want. And because God, he had not acknowledged God, he could not enjoy what he had. Now in chapter 6, we actually start a brand new strophe here. As I see the breakdown in this portion of God's Word, there are four strophes, that is, four sections. The book of Ecclesiastes, as I understand it, would be broken into four sections. I have something here which maybe I'll share with you for just a second. This happens to be an outline by, what's the man who wrote, Baxter, J. Sidlow Baxter. And in his outline, in The Quest for the Chief Good, he shows a quest by personal experiment and a quest by general observation. And then chapter 6, he starts with a quest by practical morality. And then he has the quest reviewed and concluded in the end of the chapter. And you have four basic strophes or sections or divisions in this particular book. And this is the beginning of another section. Now, in chapter 6, you find that Koheleth renews his quest in the realm of practical morality. The secret he's after is in seeing what is the golden mean. It must lie in the finding of the true center of conduct and in achieving this ever balance between things in their proper poise and balance. Now, in chapter 6, he's going to examine prosperity. Is it always good to be prosperous, or is it not? This is the question. Is this always, as we look and examine the idea of man being prosperous, is this always good? This seems to be the way we even measure sometimes spirituality among Christians. If a man is going on for God and his business is doing better and he's increasing in goods, and you know, I say, well, God must be blessing him. Well, it might be true, but it's not always true. If you recall back in Genesis chapter 26, Isaac had gone down to Gerar. Isaac had was outside of the land of Israel where blessing was to be. He wanted to go down to Egypt. The Lord permitted him in his permissive will to go down to Gerar. Now he said, don't stay there very long. Just sojourn there. But it says then he began to live there, and then it says he lived there a long time in verse 8, I think it is. Lived there a long time. He lied about his wife, and then even while he's there, God honors the covenant with Abraham, and he plants seed, and it's producing a hundredfold, and one would say, hey, look at this. Isaac is really being blessed. He's getting money even greater than the Philistines. In fact, all that the Philistines did was envy him, just exactly what Koheleth says, that the accumulation of money only brings about envy. Well, they get after this guy, Isaac, to get him out of the land, and little by little, through the various wells that were dug, the well of strife and the well of hatred and the well of enlargement, and finally he gets back to Beersheba, the well of the oath, the place where God wanted him to be. And then the Lord didn't talk to him the whole time he was down in Egypt or in Gerar. When he got back inside the land, now it says the Lord appeared to him that very night, and he pitched his tent, and he built an altar, and he called upon the name of the Lord, and he got to a place of separation unto God. And then Abimelech said, hey, now we see that God is with you. We would like to make a pact with you now. They envied him while he was down in their midst and making money. But when he was separated unto God, we now see there's something real in your life. That's a rather interesting chapter. Now, In chapter 6, he's pointing out that though a man have riches and wealth and honor, he isn't going to be able to enjoy it unless God lets him do it. You can see this in verse 2. A man to whom God hath given riches, wealth, and honor, so that he wanteth nothing for his soul of all he desireth, yet God giveth him not power to eat thereof, but a stranger eateth it. In other words, he does all of this, and a stranger is the one that benefits, not himself. John D. Rockefeller, who had one of the highest fortunes of his day, would have given half of his fortune to have had a stomach without ulcers that he could eat and have a decent, just a decent appetite, just a normal appetite. Yet he had all the money in the world and the best doctors and everything that money could provide, but it could not help. He says if a man is going to live to be 100 years, he gets 100 children, he lives many years, so that the days of his life be many, and his soul be not filled with good, what good is it? That's not going to answer. He cometh into vanity. If he, verse 6 says, yo, he live 1,000 years twice told, yet he's seen no good. In other words, it doesn't matter if you're going to live a long life if there's no end to that life, if there's no good out of that life at all. If you can't enjoy that life, what good is it? And if at the end of it, even if you live 100 years, or if you live 1,000 years, you're still going to have to die. And you can't take it with you. You can't take it with you. And so when you look at the wealth and the ability of men to have wealth, it looks like that's the answer. But things are not what they appear to be. I remember Ben Hayden telling a story about that. Things are not what they appear to be. He was riding along with a friend in Texas. And it was way out in the country, as you can do in Texas. How long can you drive in Texas without... without even seeing a house or anything else? And there along the road, there was a guy laying right along the road. I think he said the middle of the road, but I won't swear to that. He looked like he had blood all over him, and he was badly hurt. And this fellow who was a Texan that was driving the car with Ben Hayden, he just drove right by the guy and wouldn't even stop. And Ben said, what's the matter with you? Don't you see that fellow there on the road? He's hurt and he needs help. Oh, he says, he's not hurt and he doesn't need help. He said, man, I saw the blood all over the place. You should stop. No, he said, that isn't true. He says, I can't believe that. All right, he said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do. I'm going to go over the knoll of the hill here and I'm going to turn around about 2 miles down and I'm going to come back. So he turned around where the man couldn't see that he did it. He turned around and he came back and drove right past. And here was the fella leaning against the tree smoking a cigarette. It must have been ketchup or something similar to it all over his clothes. Now he says, you see what I say? Things are not what they appear to be. If you had stopped, if we had stopped and tried to help this man, as we would have bent over, he would have pulled a wrench or something out of in his hand behind him. He would have hit us over the head. He would have taken our wallets and stolen the car, and off he would have gone. And that's basically what Koheleth is saying. That you see a man that's got all kinds of riches, and the prosperity seems to be the answer to life, but beloved, he said, that's not the answer. Prosperity isn't always beneficial. Sometimes it's evil, and we need to be able to look at that very carefully. That's what he's saying here. Better in the sight, verse 9, better in the sight of the eyes than the wandering of desires. This also is vanity and vexation of spirit. That which hath been is named already and is known that it is man. Neither may he contend with him that's mightier than he. In other words, even though he gets everything that he needs, he's still going to have to contend with God. There's no better answer. And so he ends up, who knoweth what is good for man in his life all the days of his vain life, which he spendeth as a shadow. For who can tell a man what shall be after him under the sun? Better to fear God, because even if you got all the riches in the world, you'll never come up with an answer. The end.
Thank you, Bob. It was quite thorough. And yet I believe Carol would have a few additions.
I'll touch on two or three verses. quickly. The first verse of the fifth chapter says, keep thy foot when thou goest to the house of God, and be more ready to hear than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they consider not what they that they do evil. It says that when we come into the house of God, we should come reverently, we should come with a purpose, and we should come to learn. You know, one of the problems of talking is that you don't learn anything. You only learn what you already know. And when you listen, you learn something. And God saw to it that you should be learning more than you're talking, because he gave you two ears and only one mouth. And then when he gave you the tongue, he didn't attach it in the middle so you could wag it on both ends. He attached it only at the back. And then he put two guards in front of the mouth, the teeth and the lips. So you should do at least four times as much listening as you do talking. Now, I'm not a very good example of that, but that seems to be the indication, and that's what it says here, that we should listen, and we should not make rash promises and rash statements in the presence of God. We should be rather... It speaks of that as the sacrifice of fools in that passage. And then in the second verse, it says that we are not to be reckless or careless, it seems to me, in our prayers. And someone has said the measure of a prayer is not its length, but its depth. You know, when we pray, we're to be careful about what we pray. And he went and evidently and watched people in their prayers and thought that a lot of what they said wasn't too good. I remember hearing that oftentimes in our prayers, we really aren't asking God for anything or thanking God for anything and worshiping. What we're doing is we're giving God a news report. One man said, you know, God, you've been reading in the paper about the bad weather we've been having. Well, you don't have to tell God about the bad weather. Just ask him what your concern is about the weather. You see, and we do a lot of that, and it says that it is of not of great value. We had a little friend, he's about 5 years old, out in Portland, and he always gave God reports. I was over there one day and played with him, and that night he said, you know, Van Ryan was over here today, and he whooped me. That was a little game I played with him, and he said, I really liked it. Now, he's just giving God a report of what happened during the day so that God would know. But prayer is not a monologue either. It's a dialogue. We talk to God, and God talks to us. And it seems to me that's some of the things that it's saying in that verse, that not to be rash with your mouth, let not thy mouth be hasty to utter anything before God, for God is in the heaven. In other words, we're in a holy place. We're in the presence of God. Prayer should come from the heart, and it should be thought about. We should pray with a purpose. Be prepared. Think of what you're going to say. You know, everyone prays or should pray in a prayer meeting. Only one may be leading audibly, but we should all be praying, we should all be giving thanks, and we should be thinking about what we're going to say to God. Not, like they say, put your mouth in gear before your brain is engaged, but you should be thinking about what you're going to say. You should be prepared. The mouth should not be rash, and the heart must not be hasty. And then it says, as an active mind produces wild dreams, so the hyperactive mouth often produces a torrent of foolish words. I heard a man once speaking, and he was talking to God, and he was using an illustration, I should say, about God from the Word, or the Lord. And he said, hey, fella, in referring to what the disciples had said to the Lord, to make an illustration. Well, I think that's very foolish. When you and I are talking about or to God, we want to be aware of the fact that we're in the presence of the Most High God, and we should be reverent and holy concerning what we say. We hear a great deal of that today. You know, God is my buddy. That's a lot of hogwash. God is your God. He's your friend, but he's not your buddy. There's a great deal of difference. You hear it a lot in songs today. We want to be very careful. That is not so. We should be very careful in the way. And he saw that and considered that as vanity and a waste of time, I think. And then, of course, our brother touched on the vows, and we shouldn't make promises to God that we don't intend to keep. God doesn't ask promises of us, but don't make them if you don't intend to keep them. We've heard hundreds of stories, all of us, about people in foxholes who say, if you get me out of this, God, I'll serve you forever. And God gets them out of it, and they never remember him for 10 minutes afterwards. Don't make those kind of promises if you don't intend to keep them. Because it's a very rash and unwise thing to do. Just one other thing. There's a lot that we could say. My time's gone, I think, already. But in verse 11, it says, when goods increase, they are increased that eat them. And what good there is there to the owners thereof, seeing the beholding of them with their eyes. And it would seem that when you get more, it seems you get more followers as well. In other words, when you get, the more goods you get, the more hangers-on you get. I read once that Muhammad Ali, for instance, had about 55 people in his entourage, you know, following him around, bodyguards, investors, promoters, managers, somebody to shine his shoes and somebody to comb his hair and about 7 just to tell him how great he is. I think he's increased that to 10. But anyway, they've got all these followers on, and the more money you get, the more that you have along that line. And, you know, the drunk always goes in and says, drinks for everybody in the house. You see, he wants to be a friend to everybody. That's with the prodigal son. He spent all of his money. But you see, the minute the money's gone, all of those folks are gone too. And even at death, it's so you have the hangers on. You've heard that expression, where there's a will, there's a lot of relatives. You see, that's always true. But it doesn't make it better. It's better for you and I, as Christians, to use the money here in the world while we are here. You see, if I spend the money, I know it's used the way I want it to be used, and hopefully I'm using it wisely. But if I'm using the money to have all these hangers-on, I'm wasting the money to a large extent. And when I die, if I leave a lot of money, I have no idea where it's going to go, and my personal experience is that far too many times when we leave it to our kids, they waste it. Well, if it's going to be wasted, I might as well waste it. I made it, after all, you know. And but that seems to be the indication in this thing, that it's empty otherwise. If you do it any other way, it's empty. I read a story once of a lady that had 38 Cadillacs. All different colors, so they would go with her different outfits. I would have only needed 3, blue, green, and brown, to go with mine. But anyway, she had 38. But you know, the interesting thing is, I used to drive 80, 90,000 miles a year. My kids used to call me Uncle Daddy. And I drove 80, 90,000 miles a year, but I only needed one car to do it. I never was able to drive 2 at the same time, you know. The old horseman, years ago, they took another one along. When the one got tired, they hopped on the other and rode him. But I never did that with cars. I drove the same one. And, you know, the thing is that no matter how many cars you have, no matter how many bathrooms you have, no matter how many bedrooms, you can only sleep in one at the same time. You can only use one bathroom at the same time. And the thing is that you should use your money. That seems to be the indication of it. Otherwise, it all becomes, as he says, vanity, emptiness. He said, I see no purpose in it. It seems so stupid to me. That's really what he's saying.
And it really does if you analyze it. My brother went into that house in North Carolina. It has 365 bedrooms built by the Vanderbilts, I think. And the first thing my brother said was, what do they do on leap year?
Jump off the cliff.
That's all. Let thy words be few. I always think of a brother from Pittsburgh when I see these words. Let thy words be few. I wanted to be heard possibly one morning here some years ago, and this dear brother must have saw it. And on the way down to the inn, he put his hand on my shoulder, and he said, Charlie, he said, walk low, go slow, and don't blow. And that dear brother, I trust, has taught me a good lesson and phrase. Let thy words be few. Think them out first, that they may have some depth and be effective. Now, I'm saying that not in any way to dull the Spirit's movement in our midst this morning. If you have any questions, face those of us here on the platform and make your question plain and clear. And if you have any ministry to give, face the audience and give it out very clearly and intelligently. So, brethren, be free. Let the Spirit of God move in your heart. And hold up your hand if you have a question or if you have some ministry.
Well, the only way a man can come to know God is, in that day, was to become a proselyte of the Jewish nation. So although he doesn't make a big issue of it, he mentions it, and I think, yes, that would be my feeling about it. Because he's calling it the house of God. He doesn't call it a temple or some other name that you would give to not the house of a god, but the house of God. And there was only one place where God placed his name in those days, and that was in Jerusalem. Mm-hmm. And everybody knew. I think the reason he could say this, because I believe for hundreds of miles around Solomon, after the completion of the temple, because of the magnificence of it, that it was common knowledge that this was stated as being the house of God. You know, of course, as far as I understand it, that it's the most expensive building the world has ever seen. That in terms of money of 20 years ago, the temple, Solomon's temple, would be sort of rated at about $15 billion to build. $15 billion to build the temple. Just think what that gold would be worth today. As compared to then, when it was $35 an ounce, the most expensive building that's ever been erected on the face of the earth. And truly, the fame of that, as the Queen of Sheba came to hear him and hear his words and to hear about God. Yes, I would think he's suggesting to them that this is what's important.
This is an aside, but brother just touched on, and that is that we often say that Solomon was the richest man that ever lived. And when I was young, I used to think it meant he was the richest man that lived in his day. But he's the richest man up to today that ever lived in the world. Because when he built the temple, he put of his own money $7 billion in gold alone into that temple. Estimated, as our brother said, 20 years ago. $7 billion just in gold. And the richest man that's ever lived up till today has been worth about $2 billion, J. Paul Getty. So it gives you some idea of the wealth of Solomon in that day.
He was getting $1 million a year in that day, the equivalent of $1 million a year in that day, for his personal use. Just think what that would be worth today. I mean, just think what it was worth just 20 years ago, not 1,000 years ago, or 2,000 or 3,000 years ago.
Plus all the fringe benefits, 1,000 wives.
No, he only had 700 wives. 300 were
concubines. Live-in wives.
There you go.
I had the privilege of listening to an Orthodox Jew some 10 years ago when I was in the Holy Land, and he spoke to me. I said, first of all, I'm reading the Psalms of the Degrees. And he said, oh, please don't call them that. They're the Psalms of the Steps of my people. And I thought that was beautiful. And then he went on to explain how they would gather together along the way to make their way to the house of God. A little group here would meet another group, and then they would begin to sing these psalms. My feet shall stand within thy walls, O Jerusalem. Enter into his gates with thanksgiving, into his courts with praise. And the experience of just listening to that Orthodox Jew was a real delight to me, to think of how they valued the house of God and the songs that they would sing and the praise that they had. No doubt living up to the light that they had to a great degree. And they wanted to be real. I remember my Uncle Henry going to a prayer meeting, and he was a godly man. And he said, I heard a lot of beautiful prayers in that prayer meeting, but there's one I'll never forget. A dear old brother just cried out 3 times, oh God, make us real. Make us real. Make us real. Brother Lloyd.
Maybe in the second verse he's suggesting a foot and mouth disease. You know, he had the problem of always having his foot in his mouth. That isn't what it means there, of course, but the being hasty with words has the idea of putting your foot in your mouth. My feeling would be that he means there, just direct your feet toward the house of God. Make your path. Be the path to the house of God, if you please. Direct your foot in that direction so that that's where you end up, even though there are anomalies that you cannot understand, seem to us as being unfair because we cannot see the overall plan of God. Don't let that stop you, that you direct your foot to go to the house of God. That would be my feeling about it.
Brother Bill. Well, we had so many hands yesterday. Did this portion of Scripture put a little bit of a damper on us this morning? Brother Lawrence. Amen.
I was in a home in Boston, no, North Andover, Massachusetts. It's a couple that moved up from Satellite Beach and was there a number of years and moved up by GE into North Andover. And I stayed with them over a weekend last year. And when they bought their home, they looked around all over North Andover for a home. Before they would even consider whether they would buy the home, they would get in the car from that house and find how they would get to the chapel and how long it would take them to get there. And if it was too hard to do or took them too long, they wouldn't even consider the house as a possibility. As it is, they ended up about 4 minutes from the chapel and have been very, very active and helpful in that chapel, and one of the leading brethren in many areas of the ministry of that chapel. I believe it's a matter of priority in our hearts and lives. Mm-hmm. The biggest problem, as you mentioned today in the assemblies, is we have urban assemblies. The assemblies here and everybody's 10 and 15, 20 minutes, some 20 miles away. How do you get a neighbor to go 20 miles with you to the assembly, Christian or non-Christian? He says, why don't you go to, isn't this church preach the gospel down here? Why don't we go here? You know, they can't understand why we would go 20 or 25 miles, select that far distant away, because we've been pushed up into the realm of wealth that we didn't have before.
As you said, it's an aside, but I think it's well that you brought up, and I think it's good to talk about it, because the other aspect of it that really hasn't, Brother Bob touched on it, but hasn't really been talked about, is when you live close to the chapel, you do many things. For instance, when I've lived either close to the chapel or close to my business, I'm willing to go down and work 20 minutes. Whereas if it takes me 30 minutes to get there and 30 minutes to get back, I'd rather go earlier in the morning or go, you know, before the meeting or stay after the meeting. But when it's close, you're willing to do that. And the strength of the assemblies and the, of the churches and the weakness of the assemblies in these days is that if you belong to the Baptist church and you move 30 blocks away, you move your membership. People don't drive back 6 miles. There are exceptions, but for the most part, they don't drive the distance. They go to the church in the area. And if you belong to some groups, like the Catholic Church, I don't know how it is today. When I grew up in Miami, they come looking for you when you move into their area. You're notified that you've moved into the area, and they expect you to be at their church in the area. That's the normal exchange. But we, and my contention is, if you have to do what we did as young people, we had to buy out for money's sake. But we started an assembly in that area. And that's what you should do. You should start a place where you're close to it and where you can work. It's absolutely ridiculous that young people should be driving an hour to get to an assembly, in my opinion. And that's the weakness of the assemblies. In Miami, we went there in 33. There are 4 assemblies. You know how many are there today? 5. The one that my brother and I and one other young fellow started, and the original 4. Miami was 33,000. Today it's 1.5 million. Good job, right? Terrible job. We should be concerned with the reaching of people and the establishing of churches. That's our job. That's what the Lord sent the disciples out to do, and we're a part of that heritage.
I agree.
And we should be doing it.
Amen.
Brother Jack held up his hand. I'll get you next, Brother Connor. No, Jack, you're first.
There was a man once, a preacher was visiting in a home, and they were having the morning devotions, and they got down on their knees. And the father of the home was praying, and they'd been down about 10 minutes, and his knees were beginning to give out. So he leaned over to the boy in the home, about 15-year-old, and he said, is your father almost finished? And the boy listened for a minute or two. He said, no, he's not quite halfway through. We haven't got to the Jews yet. And you see, that's what you're talking about. And there is a great deal of truth in that concerning praying. Many young people are discouraged about praying because they feel that they cannot pray that way. And I like, and also not only in the meeting, but, you know, we get up, many times preachers get up and say, brother, I spend an hour every day in prayer. I spend 3 hours every day in prayer. Well, if he does that, that's fine. And I think it's a very bad thing to say it, even if he does it. And I think of the young man who came to D.L. Moody, and he said to Mr. Moody, he said, you know, I hear these older brethren who I admire say they spend an hour, they spend 2 hours, they spend 5 hours in prayer. And he said, you know, I try to spend an hour in prayer, and after 10 minutes I go to sleep, you know, on my knees, in the closet, because I can't pray that way, you know. And I like what D.L. Moody said to him. He said, well, in my lifetime, I have never prayed longer than 10 minutes. But as I've grown in the Lord, I've never gone 10 minutes without praying. God says to be instant in prayer, to persevere in prayer, to get on your knees for an hour and a half and pray about everything under the map is not what God's talking about. When I lose the keys, I take a moment and pray, Lord, help me to find the keys. When you say to me, you know, sister so-and-so just lost her husband, I take a moment to commit her to the Lord right then. You don't need to sit down for an hour and a half and pray, but you may pray the equivalent of an hour during the day. And we discourage young people by telling these things because the young person, a new Christian, can't do it. Just like when I first got up to speak, you know, I was prepared to speak for 30 minutes. I ran out of everything in 5 minutes, you know, that I had to say. And the thing is that but as you grow in the Lord, you can talk for hours. You know, now I have trouble speaking for 5 minutes. That's the problem.
There's time for everything, and I would appreciate this little lesson to go over quite well for the early morning prayer meeting. I wish you could hear our brethren pray, just 3 or 4 or 5 sentences. It just thrills you. Come out and get an illustration and a demonstration of it. 7:30 in the morning. Brother Connors is next. That's a little word of admonition for you, brother.
That's a commercial as well.
He learned that from you. I remember one time in Iowa, there was a conference, one of their big conferences, and one of our fellows from Wheaton College went out to that conference. And during the breaking of bread, this brother got up and with the most wonderful spiritual flowery language prayed for 10 minutes at the breaking of bread. And this young brother was very much impressed with such a marvelous prayer. So when he got back to home for his host's place for dinner, he said to his host, boy, he said, I was really impressed by that man's prayer. And the brother said, yes, that's true the first time you hear it.
One thing, too, brother, is what you said, you know, when you prepare, that we should prepare, and your point was that we should come prepared so we could take part. Yeah. But being prepared also enables you to take part in few words.
Yes.
You remember what Cleveland, the president of the United States, what was his first name? Grover Cleveland. When he was president, somebody once asked him, can you come and speak at our graduation at our university? And he said, well, he maybe could. He'd need to know the date. So they told him. He said, yes, I could probably come. How long would you want me to speak? And they said, well, we're not sure. How long in advance do you need to know? And he said, well, if you want me to speak for 5 minutes, I need a month. If you want me to speak for 15 minutes, I need 2 weeks. If you want me to speak an hour, I'm ready right now. You see, there's a lot of difference between saying something of value in 5 minutes or saying something of value in 30 minutes. You squeeze out all the useless words, you know, why? There's a lot of difference. So few words, I think, has many applications.
Brethren, there's been quite a few hands up. But our time is exhausted. Let's try to start here tomorrow morning, where we ended off.
Fine.
Would that be all right? And try to keep your thoughts until then. Bill's here, and the refreshments are out front, and there's a time for everything.